Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with James Lee Burke, whose new book is Robichaux. And I'll have a few recommendations for books about books. No one writes about Louisiana like James Lee Burke. He explores our landscape, both physical and cultural, in lyrical, incisive prose. And he's given us one of the all-time great Louisiana characters in Cajun cop Dave Robichaux. Now, for the first time in 5 years, Dave returns in the simply titled Robichaux. It's what you'll all be reading this January. Jim Burke, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Well, it's great to be a guest on your show again, Susan.
It's great that we're both still here. I mean, yeah. Now, you set Dave a very interesting problem in this novel. You create the possibility, or he sees the possibility, that he may have committed a homicide that he's actually investigating.
Well, that's what turns out to be the case, yes. He suddenly discovers that during a blackout, he may have committed a terrible deed.
And that's all because, driven by grief after the death of his wife, Dave
Correct.
Has started to drink again.
Yeah.
Now, I've got to tell you, Jim, when I got to that part of the book, I had to put the book down for a little while.
Yeah.
I've gotten invested in Dave's sobriety, which made me really anxious.
Yeah. Dave discovers, though, that the real enemy in his life is a force of some kind, that a presence there in Louisiana that he sees as the microcosm of a macrocosm, namely the rise of the demagogue.
Mm-hmm.
And his antecedent, the antecedents of the demagogue, are Huey Long and Joseph McCarthy and George Wallace.
Right.
And they're all rolled up into one.
And you've given him a very appealing name, haven't you? Jimmy Nightingale.
Yeah. Jimmy Nightingale. That's it. He's an enigmatic figure. He's antithetically mixed, and he has actually virtues that are admirable. But he's one of the best antagonists I think I've written about.
Well, and he and Dave have such a very complex relationship.
Yeah, that's a fact. Yeah, Dave admires him in many ways, and he keeps pulling for him, too. But Jimmy Nightingale is one of those men for whom power is insatiable. They never have enough of it.
And those kinds of guys have always been the enemy, haven't they?
Well, they are. And, of course, we give them the power they have. They do not bring their power to the table. We give it to them. And it's like we're their oxygen.
Well, Dave is especially vulnerable in this book, and he's got threats coming at him from every part of his life.
Well, he's at that time when he sees things more clearly, often, than, say, someone younger than he would see the world. And I think that's the nature of age, that we lose our denial at some point. It's kind of epistemological change in our thinking. But we realize that denial or manufacturing our own reality doesn't work very well. It wears pretty thin. And he's at that point in his life, and he knows that he's surrounded by people who want to believe in a man who is actually evil.
Right.
Jimmy Nightingale is evil.
Now, another one of the things that threads through this book is the case of the Jeff Davis Eight, of the eight women who were murdered, which is a case that's appeared in your work before. Talk about the fascination of those events.
Well, these eight murders occurred a number of years ago. Not, golly, was it going back 10 years? Does that sound right? And the murders involved the homicide of these relatively young women, who are, I think, between 18 and 25. They all knew one another. They came from little towns outside of Jennings, Louisiana, in Jefferson Davis Parish. And some of the common denominators were alcoholism, the subculture of bars and casinos, prostitution, hardcore narcotics. But their homicides have never been solved. And there has been a, in my view, probably a lack of interest. It's not uncommon. These are people who have no power. These are people who don't have mailboxes. Their lives are transient in nature, but they have no voice. And the investigations into their homicides seem lacking in many ways. So, and Dave has seen that before. I mean, this, look, anyone knows this who's spent any time around the justice system. Justice happens sometimes, but most of the time it does not. And anyone who's ever been a big violent crime knows that. It has nothing to do with the television portrayal of the system. It just doesn't. It's just that parody.
Well, it's so interesting to me. I was just thinking as you were talking that so many people talk about your work as possibly an ongoing story of American violence, but it's also an ongoing story in the change in the ability to find justice, don't you think?
Well, I think we're at a point in our history where we have choices that must be made in an immediate way. We don't have time for our mistakes anymore. And we've seen that in our recent history, I mean, since the year 2000. We've learned nothing about neocolonialism and its futility as a national policy. And that's what the Robichaux books are about. Political center was always the petrochemical expansion of an empire.
Well, the petrochemical industry was always part of the toxic gumbo in Louisiana. But another part of that is the troubling invasion of movie folk, which never ends well in these books in New Iberia. So talk a little bit about that. There's a moment, though, when novelist Levon Broussard, who's one of Dave's friends, talks about a movie version of White Doves at Morning, which is, of course, the title of one of your books.
Yeah, I'm kind of self-serving.
Yeah, you did a little bit. So
that title in there, yeah. Levon Broussard's a great character, I think. He's a novelist. He lives on Bayou Teche. He grew up in Texas and Louisiana. No one's quite sure where. I don't even think Levon is sure about his own background. But he's a man whose sensibilities and his frame of reference are divided. Again, a kind of walking contradiction in many ways, like Dave. He's a decent guy, but and he still hears the horns blowing along the road to Roncesvalles. The Roncesvalles, you know, the famous poem, the Song of Roland.
Of course.
And that's his undoing in many ways. He feels the pull of the classical era, but at the same time, he has mixed feelings about his own ancestry. He lauds the bravery of the Confederate soldiers who were in his family, but he also realizes the iniquitous nature of slavery, and it's like trying to defend original sin. And so, I mean, if you put it in a biblical frame of reference, that we enslaved our brother, it reminds me of something my great aunt Pamela Subberville was her name, and she was quite an unusual person. She was an early civil rights advocate, and she wrote very eloquently and was quite respected in New Iberia, but it was right toward the end of her life. I used to visit her, and she was bedridden in New Iberia. This was in the early 50s. I'll never forget one of her last words to me. She said, "Jimmy, our generation, hers, has committed a collective mortal sin against people of color, and your generation's going to pay for it."
Wow.
She said, "I fear for you."
Oh.
a great line.
It is a great line.
Yeah, it was Aunt Pamela. Our daughter Pamela is named for Pamela Subervile.
Well, there's a good reason to name her.
Yeah.
You know, you have written about your family, especially in White Doves at Morning. So do you really think it's your best book and your least read?
It may not be my best, but it's one of the best.
I think so, too.
But that's true of a number of my books. My three best books are Wayfaring Stranger, House of the Rising Sun, and The Jealous Kind. Nothing else I've written comes close to those three, but they're not as commercially successful as some of the others.
Well, I hope that doesn't bother you.
Well, no, that's a trilogy, the three titles I just mentioned. But I don't try to judge my own work, but I know those just almost a perfect game.
Well, what is it like for you to go back to Dave and go back to New Iberia in this book? Did it feel easy, like slipping in with an old friend, or was it a struggle to get back there after 5 years?
Oh, New Iberia is always with me from my earliest memories to the present. All my most valuable lessons were learned there. I remember when I caught my first fish, I was January of 1941. I was 5 years old. My father took me down to this big live oak tree that used to hang way out over the bayou, and I had a cane pole, and a cork went down, and I jerked it the line up with such force, it broke the cane pole in half, and a goggle-eyed perch flew into the tree. It got hung in the tree, and my father had to get a garden rake to rake it out of the tree. It was the only fish ever caught in a tree. And we put it back in the water, but I'll never forget that. We right down from that tree, and I still have these mini balls, 58 caliber mini balls. My father and I went in this chicken yard where there used to be a plantation home that was vandalized by the Yankees when they came through there in 1862. They tore the place apart. It's not all they did. They turned loose on black women. They raped black women. Those things happen. But that's what Northerners often don't understand, what federal troops did, not just in Georgia and South Carolina, but they did some really ugly things in other places as well. But anyway, I still have three of those mini balls, and I'm looking at them right now. They're on my desk that my father and I picked up. And I knew right then, remember when I was a little boy, just 5 years old, holding those in my hand, that they meant something larger than themselves. I found part of a musket once. I climbed down in a canal. I was a little boy. The canal that bleeds into Bayou Teche. And I found part of a musket just lying there in the underbrush.
Wow. Well, you've really made Louisiana your own. I think people forget that you weren't born here, that you were really born in Texas.
Yeah. But this is where I grew up. Anywhere between Houston and New Orleans would be accurate. My cousins used to put pennies on the St. Charles record track. They lived on Britannia. And we were just little guys, and we'd put the penny on the track, and a streetcar would come along, and it would mash a penny to the size of a half dollar. That's fact, or almost that big. And we, you know, it's lucky we weren't killed.
Yeah, that's true.
But do you remember the old Katz and Betts off drugstore?
Of course, of course.
And you remember the purple and green neon?
I remember purple, purple, purple.
I mean, and it was even called K&B
purple.
See it in the mist early in the morning. It was like a mystical experience. You know, and you remember the snowball carts, you know, along the Esplanade?
You certainly have a lot more of New Orleans in this book, Robichaux, which I enjoyed so much.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you liked it.
You got it.
There's more of New Orleans in this one.
And I loved seeing Cleat in such rare form.
Yeah, Cleat is, he gets indebted to all the Shylocks, you know, or that's a bad term. I guess it's not meant to be, but that's what Lone Shark sharks are called in the underculture. You know, they're Shylocks, they're really terrible guys. But he ends up owing about, you know, $200,000 to these guys. But he also, we see Bobby Earle surface again. This is a guy that Clete Purcell genuinely hates.
You can't make this stuff up, as they say.
Oh, that's a fact. Louisiana is a gift from God. It's the most eccentric place in the United States. I mean, people think weird was invented out on the West Coast. Wrong. We got it right in South Louisiana. So it's an eccentric culture. It's impossible to shock people with eccentricity in Southern Louisiana. But Tennessee Williams grew up in Mississippi. When he came to New Orleans, he thought he was in heaven. He couldn't believe it. It's the Bears of Caracalla.
Oh, my gosh. I know. You and I always have these conversations where we break up in laughter. I mean, you have to admit, you make such beauty out of the place. Well, that is always the big part of your books, and that is always why people love them so much.
Well, thank you. But look at the people who come to New Orleans and they never leave it.
So do you have any hope for Louisiana? You think we're ever getting better?
Well, what's daunting is, of course, the treatment of the environment.
Of course.
That's the big one. Because you can't undo those. When you cut 200-year-old trees down, you can't get them back. And a great deal of the area has been despoiled. And I don't think it was necessary. It doesn't have to be either or. I mean, there's demonstrable evidence that creating urban forest, for example, and it not only makes it a better place to live, but it makes it more valuable in terms of the property. But I think an enormous amount of damage has been done, and it's discouraged. It is. And, you know, the cavalier attitude of throwing trash, you know, up and down the highways. It's, remember Dave Robichaud's statement? He said that falling in love with Louisiana is like falling in love with the great whore of Babylon.
Ah, yep. He's always said that.
Yeah. So, you know, laissez les bon temps rouler, kind of self-congratulatory hedonism.
Well, one of the things that troubles me most is that Dave's dragons are not going to go away. They're just going to stick around. And that's good for writers, but I think bad for us, you know?
I'm afraid it's bad. It doesn't bode well, and I don't think it will change in our lifetime.
All right. Well, that's some wisdom for the new year. We've been talking with James Lee Burke, whose new novel is Robichaud, which will be published January 2nd, 2018. Jim, Happy New Year to you, and thank you so much.
Well, thanks a lot.
Books have inspired some surprising songs. The philosopher Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now inspired Nothing You Can't Lose by Steel Wheels from their 2010 album Red Wing. Songwriter Trent Wagler said he wrote it in the middle of the housing crisis, trying to write about finding peace in a very difficult moment.
Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your sister, tell some stranger, there ain't nothing you have that you can't lose. So give me love, let me down, drag my name all over this town. No regrets, no revenge, no excuse. 'Cause I've been up in the sky, I've been down, I won't lie. It ain't easy, any path that you choose. So get you God, or get you demons. Take to silence I'll start to screaming, but there ain't nothing you have that you can lose. So strip me down to the place where I was when I came on board. Every path that you take will have you knocking on the same old door. But take your time breathing in strange comfort, but in the end there ain't nothing you have that you can lose, yeah. You've been told all your money ain't no good on this cruise. If your luck has been low, if you're down and you just don't know, take some courage, because here's the news that you can tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell my mama, go tell some stranger, there ain't nothing you have that you can lose. So strip me down to the place where I was when I came on board. Every path that you take will have you knocking on the same old door. But take some time, breathe it in strange comfort, but in the end there ain't nothing you have that you can lose. There ain't nothing you have that you can lose.
Every book lover has a favorite type of book. I'm partial to books about books and reading and publishing, and the past year brought a lot of those. Here are some of my favorites. Printer's Error, Irreverent Stories from Book History by Rebecca Romney and J.P. Romney, is a collection of fascinating stories about books. Whether you're interested in noted forgeries or Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Woman when she was trying to make a living as a writer, you'll find something of interest here. We learn about Benjamin Franklin's life as a printer, Charles Dickens' American tour, and the fascinating story of the Dove's typeface, which its creator tossed into the Thames. It's a rollicking good time, and you'll learn a lot, too. Dear Fahrenheit 451, Love and Heartbreak in the Stacks, A Librarian's Love Letters and Breakup Notes to the Books in Her Life, by Annie Spence, is a completely charming look at a librarian's life in books. Spence loves Jeffrey Eugenides' Virgin Suicides with a heartfelt affection. But 50 Shades of Grey, as told by Christian, not so much. As she says, "You made me say erotica to a little old lady, Grey. I'm going to hate you forever for that." There are also some terrific essays riffing on the bookish life, such as The Fancy Bookshelf at a Party I Wasn't Technically Invited to, The Magnificent Library in Beauty and the Beast, and Books I Imagine My Upstairs Neighbor Reads. One thing's for sure, we need readers like Annie Spence in our libraries. I'd be glad to take her recommendations anytime. Origins of a Story, The True Inspirations Behind the World's Greatest Literature by Jake Rogan, was inspired by the story of his favorite book, Watership Down. He tracked down the origins of 201 other books, and chances are you'll find a favorite among them. Did you know Dr. Seuss wrote Green Eggs and Ham to win a bet he could write a book with only 50 words? Then there's The Tale of Peter Rabbit, which Beatrix Potter wrote to cheer up her governess' son, who was ill. And Walker Percy was inspired by French philosophical novels such as Sartre's Nausea to write his Southern-style philosophical novel, The Moviegoer. Morningstar, Growing Up in Books by Anne Hood, is a revealing story of the novelist's young reading life. I love that Herman Wilkes' Marjorie Morningstar was so important to her, just as it was to so many women our age. And then the Herod experiment by Robert Rimmer, which was passed around by college students as a parable of sexual liberation. Hood frames her memoir as a series of 10 lessons, from how to dream to how to run away, and it is a complete pleasure to learn those lessons along with her. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Room 220 presents readings by Brad Richard, Andy Young, and other local authors Monday, January 1st at 5 p.m. at Antenna Gallery on St. Claude Avenue. One Book, One New Orleans has narrowed down the shortlist for the 2018 selection. The three books are The People's Grocer, John G. Schwegman, New Orleans and the Making of the Modern Retail World by David Capello, Roll With It, Brass Bands and the Streets of New Orleans by Matt Sacchini, with artwork by Willie Birch, and New Orleans, A Food Biography by Elizabeth M. Williams. Check out the Facebook page for info on voting for your choice. Deadline is January 6th. Nathaniel Rich discusses his new novel, King Zeno, with Katie Simpson Smith, Tuesday, January 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Amy Stewart discusses her new crime novel, Miss Cop's Midnight Confessions, Tuesday, January 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. Peter Marino discusses and signs Down and Out New Orleans, Transgressive Living in the Informal Economy, Thursday, January 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Linda Thurman discusses and signs A Brief History of Hollywood South, Thursday, January 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Fun with Big Fat Books reading group starts its spring season with As I Lay Dying, beginning January 23rd for 3 weeks, following that up with The Sound and the Fury, beginning February 19th. Email Abita Blaylock, ABITABLAYLOCK, at gmail.com for information and fees. And a big bravo to the Baton Rouge Public Library System. Library Journal, the premier national publication for libraries, has awarded the system its highest rating, 5 stars. The East Baton Rouge system is the only one in the state to receive an award from Library Journal. The award is based on how many people are using library services, such as circulation in paper and electronic resources, the number of visitors and attendees at library programs. Well done. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at TheReadingLife@WWNO.org.